Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. This program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Fred Monroe continues to host the program from home with continuing concerns about protecting us all from the COVID virus. Today, in honor of Independence Day, Fred is being joined by two guests from the Cal Poly Political Science Department. They will examine the current challenges and future prospects for this experiment we call democracy. Join Fred and his guests for this frank and important discussion today. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation. Call 805-549-8855 or email your questions to voices at KCBX. Now, let's join Fred Monroe and his guests. Over to you, Fred.
Right. Thanks, Brad. Appreciate being able to do the program again today. Chris Kington Barker is on vacation. So for those of you who are regular listeners who might have it marked on your calendar, yes, this is really normally Chris's week, but she's gone and I'm holding the fort down for her for a little while. As we've told you before, but I'll tell you again, we really want to look at one of the goals that we have, which is getting credible, valid information and insights from diverse members of our communities. The issue of how democracy is faring in the United States is indeed one of those topics. We want to talk about how today's choices really affect tomorrow's community, and sometimes changes are things we can work with well. Sometimes they're incredible challenges. This is 4th of July weekend. So today on Central Coast Voices, we're going to take a look at one of the things that 4th of July really involves, and that is our independence, our government, and our democracy. Currently, our democracy is, for lack of a better word, challenged by a number of things. It's fragile. We're doing our best to keep it alive and healthy, but sometimes we don't quite know how to do that. So today we're going to talk to some folks from Cal Poly Political Science Department about that very fact. Just a few months ago, extremists attempted to overthrow the U.S. government in an insurrection. We can probably talk about whether or not some people don't even believe that was a threat to our government or an insurrection, and others who are very, very concerned. State legislators across the country are passing legislation to add restrictions to the voting process. For some people, that's an effective way to streamline the process. For others, that's a way to make it difficult for others to vote. It's part of the discussion we're going to have today. I usually find if we can talk about politics, it's fascinating, even though sometimes we would prefer the discussion just be over. My guests today are from the Cal Poly Political Science Department, Dr. Nancy Arrington, who's an associate professor, Dr. Michael Latner, who's a professor, and he's also a senior fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists Center for Science and Democracy. We're going to take a look at this experiment we call democracy and figure out whether or not we're going to survive it to do it for a while longer, or whether or not we have something that's in peril. If you want to be part of this discussion, please give us a call at 805-549-8855. Pardon me. You can also email us at voices@kcbx.org. If you have long drawn out questions, we may not get a chance to get to them on the radio, but I will assure you that unless you specifically ask us not to do so, I will forward them to our guests, and they may give you an equally complex answer to your complex question that we can't get to on the radio. Welcome, Michael and Nancy. I'm glad you're here today. This is the kind of discussion that some people find just annoying. Others of us enjoy it. We'll hopefully make this hour as enjoyable and as not annoying as possible. I guess probably the way to start this from my perspective is, did we have an insurrection in January? And how do we define that? And do we have a way of addressing the concerns of some people that it's been, quote, blown out of proportion, and it wasn't anything like that at all? And now I'm just going to hide under my desk for a while, and the two of you can go from there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Mike, you want to you want to jump in, or you want?
Yeah, I'll take a stab. Thanks for having us, as Fred. This is a really good opening question, because we, Nancy and I, haven't consulted about any of this ahead of time, so we don't know if we agree with each other or not. I would certainly put myself in the camp that what we saw was an insurrection. It was an attempt to stop the peaceful transfer of power. It was at a minimum, an attempt to stop the certification of the electoral vote. And so I think by any definition that it counts as an attempted insurrection. People died. The worst case scenario, I mean, what would have happened if the mob would have found Vice President Pence and would have found, gotten into the House floor? So I certainly put myself in the camp that it was an insurrection, and largely, that it, to the extent that it was a failure, it failed very much for the same reasons that the Trump presidency wasn't as effective as it could have been. It was really more incompetence and lack of organization than any lack of intent. I think the intent was clearly there. So,
yeah, I think I mostly agree with Mike there. What happened in January was deeply scary for me. I think for many of us, I do consider it an insurrection, but I think there's an interesting question there about where the boundary between protest and insurrection is and exists. And I don't actually know, right? And there's a piece of American political culture that I seem to observe, and I think is reasonable, that part of our political culture is this idea of we the people are in charge. And I think some of the rhetoric of those insurrectionists was a misguided or maybe miscalculated attempt at, you know, expressing their preferences and trying to participate, right? Now, definitely that went very, very wrong. It was violent. It was dangerous. It was deeply scary. And I do think it qualifies as an insurrection. But that conversation about the boundary between protest that's appropriate and an attempted violent overthrow of the government is maybe an important one to have at this juncture of our political trajectory.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Nancy. It also points up to the uncertainty that Fred spoke of, right? I mean, these people largely see themselves mm-hmm. as patriots, right? And see themselves as upholding at least the idea of the Constitution rather than what they did, which was mm-hmm. subvert it.
So, this is a question I have not heard a reasonable answer to. Not that I haven't heard an answer. It's not that I haven't heard an answer I agree with or feel comfortable with. I really haven't heard what I would consider to be a defendable answer. If Congress had indeed not certified the election, what would we have done?
Oh, boy, there really isn't a clear answer, and anyone that claims to have one, I think, is misleading you, because it really, I mean, it becomes such a political process, right? I mean, there are a handful of laws on the books designed to govern that process, but it's purely political at that point, right? I mean, it really matters what the strengths of the parties are in both chambers and what sort of parliamentary moves are available on the part of the party leadership. So I couldn't give a clear answer as to what would have happened.
One of the things that listeners may not realize this, but we send a questionnaire out to all of our guests with some questions of them. And one of the questions that we send out to you is what are things that people may have as a misconception, or there's two categories. One is real questions about a topic, and one is misconceptions. And Michael, I'm going to read this verbatim the way you responded, which I don't do often, because I think it just needs to be addressed as a response to that verbatim. And you're not hung out to dry on this one. America has been a strong democracy, only recently weakened. You actually list that as a misconception, which leads me to believe that we have deluded ourselves to some extent that our peaceful coexistence with our peers politically is not a strong foundation we're standing on. It's somehow something we've never figured out how to knock over. So therefore, it's a little more precarious than we may realize.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm motivated by two factors when I wrote that down. And one is the idea that, you know, of course, America is a democracy. I mean, frankly, from political science standards, current standards that we use in comparative political science, we would never have referred to the United States as even a liberal democracy until 1965. And so the idea, I mean, we systematically excluded African Americans in the South and other populations in the South and Southwest. So there's that. But I think an equally important point to raise is that structure matters now, right? In a way that it doesn't seem to have mattered as much in the past. And by that, I mean, we're talking about the filibuster. We're talking about malapportionment of population in the Senate and the way that the Senate's unrepresentative. And we're having all these conversations as Americans in a way that we weren't having, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. It was sort of the structure of the Senate was sort of taken for granted. But in fact, there are a number of really undemocratic elements to the Constitution and to our system of government. And they're relevant now because our politics have aligned in a way that exacerbates and amplifies the sort of undemocratic nature of those institutions. And that, I think, is a fascinating phenomenon. And it's a huge challenge, right? Because the structure of the Senate, at least the electoral structure of the Senate, isn't going to change anytime soon, right? Changing the Constitution's very difficult. And so I think that's something that's interesting to talk about.
Go ahead.
And one point
jump in.
Yeah, just to carry on what Mike was saying, I think a silver lining to this moment that we're in that feels kind of scary and precarious, and we're not sure where it's going, is that perhaps some of the reasons it feels so precarious is because over the last 40 years, we now have far more people invested in the political process and aware of it and with access to information so that things can't get swept under the rug the way they might have been able to be many years ago. So what seems like things are falling apart could be things falling apart, but it could be things going on as usual. And we now just have access to that information in ways that we didn't before. And I'm not fully sure which world we're in, probably a little bit of both, but I think that is a good part of this moment that we're in is that so many people are aware of what's going on in politics and invested in it and have informed, relatively informed opinions about it. And that's a cool thing, I think.
Yeah, I want to take that a little step further, and that is that people have a vested interest that helps them better pay attention and keep up with it. But we also have seemed to be living in a world where delusional reaction to things becomes more prominent because the ability to put things out. I can put something on my Facebook page that I got from five other sources, and all of a sudden 10,000 people through the dominoes of something like Facebook now believe it or see it and instantly believe it. And it seems like we've created an environment where that flow of information is good to have at a moment's notice. But it's real hard to turn the faucet off. We have people who are telling us regularly that mainstream media, people telling us regularly that NPR, our affiliate at KCBX here, which we're an affiliate of them, pardon me, they're not the other way around, that these are all falsehoods, that the information being shared by everyone is false. And it seems like that discussion gets to the point where everybody is just listening to and paying attention to that which they already believe in, which means they're never hearing any challenge to that that's realistic. I suspect the two of you, that's the nature of probably a political science classroom. from a standpoint of, you know, if somebody gets called out in one of your classes by something they allude to or allege, you may have five or six sources to back it up and prove it otherwise. But those don't make it to Facebook. Those don't make it to Instagram. And they may not make it to OAN television. Have we gotten to a point where we can't undo this instant belief that whatever I just read that so-and-so said is obviously true, or it wouldn't be there?
That is a great question, both politically and pedagogically. Right? Like,
okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, how
I'm honored
how,
you thought that way.
and I don't have an answer for it. I thought a lot about it, and I think that this, you know, proliferation of social media and non-trustworthy sources and people taking non-trustworthy sources at face value is an issue. But maybe self-importantly, one of my reads of this issue is it really emphasizes to me the importance of a well-rounded civic education. So I spend a lot of times in my class talking about measurement, right? So if we have some concept called corruption, how would we go out and observe it? And what things would we count to know that it's there or not? And it's on its surface seems like a silly thing. Like, well, you just go out and you look for corrupt people. But it's a hard thing to do. Finding good evidence and classifying that evidence and communicating it requires a lot of skill. And it's a skill that is increasingly important. So here's my plug for undecided high school seniors to be political science majors. But I think that that's a skill that is going to be increasingly important over time, because filtering through reliable and unreliable information takes a lot of time and effort. And it is a skill that if you have not learned, of course, you're not going to know how to do it, right? Like, you know, people don't just know how to swim and know how to, I don't know, throw a football. They have to learn those things. And data literacy and information literacy is also a thing that can be learned.
Yeah. Let me jump in just for a second and remind folks, you can give us a call at 805-549-8855 or email us at voices@kcbx.org. And we can go ahead and have our guests be part and make you part of the discussion. One of the things that comes to mind that you might want to ask as a listener is, you know, do you feel that we really have a future for democracy in America? Do you feel like that we're really going in a direction that's consistent with what you believe the democracy should be? You know, have you observed any threats to democracy or how you perceive democracy in San Luis Obispo County? Because the issue of whether or not politics is local or national is an ongoing discussion. I'll let my guests talk about this for a little further, but by most of my people that I've spoken to about it imply that local politics is the foundation of what we are, and less and more so than national politics, because it's where it all starts. And it's what we deal with on a daily basis. Go to a Board of Supervisors meeting in San Luis Obispo County, and you'll understand why it's important that the discussion be known to locals. I suggest to you that where we are right now is scary. And what are we not doing with that fear that may be constructive? I'm sorry to reword that. That was bad. That was, yeah, anyway. What are we ignoring from the current fear we have that it's going to continue a negative path we seem to be kind of teetering on?
Gosh, that's a great question. Maybe in some respects, and you know, there. I mean, I think certainly within our discipline of political science, there's actually, you know, there isn't consensus that our democracy is at great risk right now. There's a large body of people that, you know, have signed on to a number of public letters, and, you know, talk about and do research on why this is the case. But, it, you know, it's not universal. And, you know, there are many folks who are more optimistic that, you know, our institutions are stable and we're going to weather this storm. But I guess I would say that people should be concerned, not just nationally, but locally as well. I mean, I think that if you look at our own Board of Supervisors race, not race, but the decision, that long meeting with Clerk Recorder Tommy Gong, who presented the results of the election, and the board had to decide what voting systems they wanted to adopt for the coming year. You know, that meeting itself just devolved into a number of racist, propagandistic rants from people calling in. So this authoritarian threat that I'm concerned about, I think we see it not just nationally, but locally. It's a threat here as well. And it's a threat to our democracy on all scales.
Nancy.
Yeah. No, that's another good question that I don't have a clear answer to. It's the theme of the hour. You know, I think it's this idea of how at risk is U.S. democracy is a hard question. It's a hard empirical question, right? Because we can't measure the future. So whether or not this moment we'll look back on and be like, well, of course things are going to get worse, or we'll look back on and be like, oh, remember that time we all overreacted? We're not going to know until the future is the past, right? Like until you build a time machine, or until we just wait it out, we're not going to really know. But democracy requires nurturing. Right. It doesn't just happen on its own. It requires that people believe in institutions and willingly participate in them and yield to the processes that we've all agreed on, or, you know, or at least our founders agreed on, to organize our world. So I think there's this, you know, kind of binary take on this moment where some are deeply, deeply anxious to the point of panic, right? Like it's all going to fall apart right now. And maybe it will, I don't know. But I think there's this other contingent that's like, oh, it's all overblown. You know, we've been around this long, we'll keep going. And I think the truth is somewhere in between, probably for me a little bit more on the side of anxiety, but that might just be how my brain functions. So there's no harm in thinking through how we can promote democracy in the United States. And that can take lots and lots of forms. And this is really Mike's expertise about different institutional changes that might promote the vibrancy of our elections and promote the legitimacy and representativeness of our elections. But I think before we can get there, we have to have this conversation about whether or not the way we've already done it is good enough. You know, and I think the way we've already always done it has done some good things. There has been progress over time and in what it means to live a good life in the United States. And that's something that we can be proud of. But just because it used to be done that way doesn't mean that it's the best way. You know, and I had this aha moment as an undergrad, as a government major, where I was like, oh, we're a democracy. I guess what democracy means is you go in and you vote for one of two parties. And I took a comparative politics class and it's like, wait, so there are democracies and other places that do it in different ways. And like, no one told me about it. And I was just like, aha moment that put me on the path to being a political scientist, because we can use institutions. And what we mean by institutions, of course, is like the structures that we agree to live by in a community. We can use those institutions to try to promote or discourage different outcomes, right? And so there's a choice over rules, and a choice was made, you know, 220 years ago, and those choices are made as new legislation is passed, as courts, you know, rule on legislation. But I think this is a good time for a conversation about what outcomes we care about most, and then backwards, like, what institutions are going to get us there, and whether or not we should think about changing some of our political institutions to promote those features.
Yeah, gosh, I couldn't agree more. I think the sort of now point that I think is super important there is that whether you're paranoid and anxious and scared to death, or you think this is all overblown, the reality is that it's not as though the United States is just going to implode, right? Even if you're quite scared and quite concerned as I am, rather what we see when we look at democratic decline, and we've got a lot of comparative data, we have a lot of people that study the emergence and the decline of different types of government. And so we know that what we're likely to see is a kind of erosion, right? It's not going to be that everything ends overnight, but we're already frankly seeing that. And so when you know, I get really concerned when I see things like the laws in Georgia and Arizona and Texas that are allowing state legislatures to co-opt or to usurp the authority of elected administration officials, for example, because that's the kind of stuff that we see in Belarus and Hungary and India and other places. Those are indicators, right? Those are some of the ways that we measure the integrity of elections and the integrity of democracy. And so those are the things that I'm concerned about seeing happening in the United States. But what we'll end up being is just a more flawed democracy. And frankly, you know, we've been there before. To Nancy's point, the story of American democracy is a story of struggle and a story of expansion of equality and voting rights. That is the story of our country. And it always comes through struggle. It always comes through people, you know, in many cases, putting their lives on the line. That's what the abolitionist movement was about. It's what the women's rights movement was about, to give women, you know, half the population the franchise. And it was obviously what the civil rights movement was about. And so I think I really take Nancy's point to heart that this is not a spectator sport. And historically, it means that we have to ask ourselves, what kind of a democracy do we want?
When you use the words, this is not a spectator sport, which I agree with and I understand, I also understand that for a lot of people, they've turned it into a protester sport. During the 60s, a lot of change came about because minority populations, not necessarily ethnic and racial minorities, but minority populations of younger people, minority populations of people who did not have as much of an economic standing, became vocal, because if you're a minority of any kind, you generally do not control the flow of information and power. However, the Republican Party in the United States is statistically right now a minority party. And I'm wondering whether or not that assumption about protest from minority becomes more of an effort not to protest, but to short circuit or stop a process. What comes to mind for me is, if you go back a number of years, when Kevin McCarthy was first a representative, his district bumped over into San Luis Obispo County, and he was interviewed by the Tribune at one point, and I'm not quite sure who originally did the interview, about what he felt his goal was as a new member of Congress. And his response was, this is not verbatim, and I apologize for not having a copy of it, but his response was to strengthen the Republican Party. And the media didn't even challenge that from a standpoint of, is your goal to represent your district, or is your goal to represent your party? And that stuck around for a while. And then Mitch McConnell, when Barack Obama was first seated as president, put out a comment that his job as Senate Majority Leader at the point at which this happened was to make sure that Barack Obama was a one-term president. So you had the leading senator not even talking about what his goal was for the benefit of the country or his own constituents, but just what it was from a political standpoint. And I talked too long, which now means we need to go to our break. So I would like to give both Nancy and Michael a minute or so while we take the break to maybe enlighten me about where that fits and why no one finds that to be a problem, or few people find that to be a problem. This is Central Coast Voices. We're having a discussion about trying to make sure that democracy survives in the United States. My guests today are Michael Latner and Nancy Arrington, both professors at Cal Poly in political science. And we'll be back with you shortly.
If you're looking for real country music on the radio, then Across the Tracks is for you. Hi, I'm Brad Kyle. Join Blair Gillespie and me as we play roots, country, and related music like honky-tonk, outlaw, western swing, rockabilly, bluegrass, and more. Tune in every Thursday night right after The Road Home for Across the Tracks from 8 to 10 here on KCBX or anytime on demand at kcbx.org. And we'll see you right over there, Across the Tracks.
Hi, I'm Fred Friedman. Thursday evenings, I enjoy playing music for you on Jazz Liner Notes from 10 p.m. until midnight. Or you can listen anytime on demand at kcbx.org.
Celebrating as one nation after a year of divisions exposed. Families torn.
She said, Daniel, they reprogram your DNA.
Social media sharpens the divide.
Nazis dox my address.
The arts brings us together. Join us as we explore our divided states and the struggle to pull together when things fall apart.
You can hear this special broadcast, Divided States, Efforts to Pull Together, Monday afternoon from 1 to 2 p.m. right here on KCBX. From the KCBX Community Calendar, the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum is presenting a lecture on July 15th titled Hawaiians, Catholics, and a Town with a Bay in Front and an Amphitheater of Hills Behind, the Education of Richard Henry Dana Jr. in Santa Barbara. This virtual event will inform listeners about what Santa Barbara was like from 1835 to 1836. To register and to learn more, you can visit sbmm.org. Ahead on our Thursday here on KCBX, it's Fresh Air from 3 to 4 p.m., Marketplace from 4 to 4:30, followed by All Things Considered from 4:30 to 6:30. Right now, let's return to Fred Monroe and his guests on Central Coast Voices. Over to you, Fred.
Thank you, Brad. Appreciate being with you all today. My guests are Michael Latner and Nancy Arrington, professors at Cal Poly in political science, a topic that we can always guarantee keeps the hour lively. If you would like to be part of the conversation, you can give us a call at 805-549-8855. Email us at voices@kcbx.org. I posed a complex question before the break, and I'm sorry that I was a long-winded question we didn't get to before the break. But I guess the real question is, in my mind, do we have office holders who are more concerned about the perpetuation of the interest of their party versus the interest of the whole country? Who wants to jump in first?
I'll go. And I think that question has several approaches and it's got a couple of answers, but I am not convinced that those two things are mutually exclusive, right? I think someone can be very motivated to increase the power and reach of their party because they think by increasing the power and reach of their party, they're doing good for the United States. You know, I think that, there are, power seeking people, but I think a lot of politicians are, even if they are power seeking, are power seeking and policy seeking. So this idea that someone by prioritizing their party is necessarily harming the United States. Well, I mean, I guess that's kind of an empirical question, but from motivation, I think that it can be a genuine motivation to do good for the United States, right? By putting forth someone's or by prioritizing their approach to what good for the United States looks like.
Yeah, I would largely agree. When we think about what political parties are, they're organizations that collectively represent the interest of activists and people that have very specific policy ends. And the fact of the matter is that in any free society, you're going to have very different groups with very different opinions about what's best for the country. And that's what we're seeing in our partisan competition. I think it's an important point to to recognize that a lot of the conversation about what's wrong with American democracy does revolve around this question of polarization, right? Partisan polarization, it's increased, and that's absolutely true, right? There's no question that the parties are more ideologically homogenous and are more ideologically extreme than at any time. There's less cooperation between the parties right now than at any time since the Civil War, right? That's pretty well empirically documented. But that doesn't mean that polarization per se is the problem. And I don't think that it is, because if it is the problem, then the solutions are going to be, well, how do we try to reduce polarization? How do we do a little more moderates? We need to weaken the political parties because they're too extreme. And I think all bad solutions. So I think it's an important point that it's not polarization per se that's the problem. What we have is a problem where the interests of parties are less aligned. Again, I guess I go back to institutions, that the institutions aren't forcing the sort of accommodation and compromise that our institutions were built for, and that's largely because the coalitions within the parties have shifted, and so now because we don't have conservatives and liberals in both parties, and frankly because we only have two parties, right? That's part of the problem. So it's very difficult to do the work of democracy and the bargaining and compromise that our institutions are supposed to incentivize when there's no one, you know, in the middle to make deals. And in fact, the incentive is to dig your heels in and to not cooperate. And that's what we're seeing nationally, obviously.
Some of the turns the process has made, I would consider rather startling. And one of the ones, it's kind of a benchmark in my brain, because I've paid attention to politics for a long, long time. I worked as a volunteer for my first congressional campaign when I was 9 years old, by the way, to the chagrin of my father, who was opposing the candidate that I was supporting that went on to be my Congress member for about 25 years after that.
Troublemaker.
Yeah. But what I'm thinking about is there was this benchmark or good barometer in my head for a number of years, and that was when Joe Biden and Lindsey Graham could still be friends, it seemed like there was a hope for discussions among people of differing views. It's gotten very disturbingly ugly, in my opinion, just in the last 6 to 8 years. And to some extent, some people would say that the minute that the country elected a clear racial minority president, that the need for some people to have a real firm dividing line got more important, or a lack of that dividing line got more scary for them. I'm wondering whether or not that's one of the things that started this process, is that that shook up a lot of people's view of what the status quo should be.
I think there's no question that the election of Barack Obama did amplify some of the sort of smoldering elements of the far right in the United States, but you know, that's always been there, right? And in fact, I think it's important to keep in mind, again, from a historical perspective, one of the reasons why senators and Congress were more cordial and seemed to get along with each other is that there was systematic exclusion in our political system, right? I mean, the Democratic Party, we have a two-party system, but this is really the first generation of Americans to live under a true two-party system. And by that, I mean, if you go back 30, 40, certainly prior to the Civil Rights Movement, we really had a kind of a two-and-a-half, three-party system, where you had a large body of segregationists, the party of white supremacy, that actually controlled most of the committee system in Congress. And so there was really this coalition of small government Republicans and labor-based Democrats, along with this white supremacist section of the electorate that govern. And so and part of what we're seeing, I think, to your point, is that the demographic changes happening in our country are certainly spurring part of what we're seeing in people's political behavior. The fact that, you know, within 10 years or so, we're going to be a majority minority country, right? Or that there will be no racial or ethnic group that has the white majority will no longer be there. So that's certainly part of it. But it's also, you know, I think that there are other factors that make that more complex as well, namely economic inequality and the changing nature of the economy and people's jobs and their livelihoods and their communities.
Yeah. And I don't, I'm still thinking through that question. I think there were like 18 questions hidden in there, which is the mark of an interesting question. I don't have fully formed opinions on how hard and how bad polarization is for US democracy. I do think that it is far more bad than good, right? Because we're in a world now where we don't need coalitions, right? One party has 50.1% at least of the seats, and then they get to do what they want to do. And the outcome of that is like a flipping and flopping of policy approaches over time. And that is not ideal because it makes planning hard, because it makes politics exist in this world of deep uncertainty over paradigms of policy. And that's problematic for people planning their lives, because we don't know what the future is going to really look like. But at the same time, like, of course, that's the way it is, because the way our institutions are designed, we don't need coalitions. If you have 50% of the votes and you control both houses in Congress, why would you need to be friends with the other side? Right. So one solution to this, and again, I'm revealing my hand as an institutional scholar, but one approach is to redesign some of our institutions so that we have no one majority, or we have a majority that depends on building coalitions. I guess that's my comment.
Well, as I really appreciate your answer. And by the way, I think for the record, I'll say on the air, I think this is a discussion I'd like us to continue having every day if possible. both of you are fascinating to have this conversation with, and I hope our listeners are enjoying it and learning from it. I have to interject this, and I'm sorry if it's just the white elephant that nobody can sell. And I want to get back to the filibuster we haven't talked about, because what we have is we have a minority party in the Senate, ever so slightly technically. We have a minority party in the House, and the majority party is willing to let them continue keeping a control over the final outcome of almost anything that requires both houses to have action by the filibuster. I would love some enlightenment as to why that just doesn't go away. The filibuster does not, as I understand it, exist in law. It is a procedural tradition.
That's right. Yeah, it's a procedural rule, so it can be changed by majority rule in the Senate.
So for clarification, I want to make sure I'm not making an assumption here that's going to blow up in my face. It doesn't, you can't filibuster the right to have the filibuster go away, correct? So 51 votes to remove the filibuster cannot be filibustered by somebody else. Okay.
That's right. I mean, any procedural rule takes... works under majority rule.
So the Senate but the Senate Democrats have the technical capacity, they may not choose to use it, to make the filibuster go away.
They would if they had the votes, but that's the thing, is they don't have the votes. So, I mean, most of us know about Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema as Democrats that are publicly opposed. But frankly, my understanding and the rumors that I hear are that there are actually other Democrats that are hesitant and opposed to changing the filibuster as well. And part of this is for exactly the reason that Nancy just pointed to, right, is the fact that there is so much uncertainty and there isn't a sort of – you can't look too far down the game tree in American politics. And that makes it, that level of uncertainty makes legislators very risk averse, in the sense that Democrats know that they're going to be in the minority at some point. And rather than advocating for democracy and more fluid policymaking, they're scared, and they're looking to protect their short-term interests.
What's confusing to me there, though, Mike, is whether or not preserving the filibuster actually preserves any of the interests, because if that only works if the other party also preserves it. And I don't, based on the Republican Party of the last several years, they're shrewd users of rules to get what they want. And so it seems deeply short-sighted to me for the Democrats to be okay just letting this rule languish.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I'm even more puzzled, frankly, by Joe Manchin's actual position, because he would become the pivotal vote on everything.
It makes him the most powerful person in that body. You know, like, absolutely. Sometimes politics is weird.
Yeah. It is super puzzling. Super puzzling.
Well, thanks for the answers that don't get us a solution, but I appreciate it. So, I'll put this out to...
We should have Kristen Hartog on for that answer. Maybe we can phone him in. He's our resident Congress expert.
Okay, but we'll have him join us next time, and that would be good too. what are your, for both of you, what do you feel the best and the worst scenarios are as we move forward? Because to some extent, I would say government is federal government at the moment is under gridlock. States are more controlled by the party that doesn't even control Washington at the moment. What are the scenarios?
Oh gosh, I think it's worse than that. I think the state legislatures are controlled by entrenched minority parties that have made themselves governing parties through gerrymandering. So I guess my looking forward, the best paths that I see, I don't see congressional action happening, in part for what we've just been discussing with regard to the filibuster. I think it's really important to note, just this morning, we saw democracy take another blow. The Supreme Court handed down an awful decision that replaced basically the results tests and the intent test within Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And it's now going to be much harder to bring voting rights cases by a 6-3 majority. The conservatives basically are arguing that you can have some discriminatory effect, but how much really is what matters. And it's an awful ruling for a number of reasons. But I still think it leaves open some possibility for the Biden administration to use the Voting Rights Act to sue states like Georgia and other places, and they will probably have some luck with at least the most egregious examples of political power grabbing. Again, this idea of state legislatures taking over and the control over the certification of the vote. I think that they'll sue that. And the other pathway is really from the ground up. I think that people have got to be engaged. Part of the flip side of the kind of social media threat to democracy is that information is more democratized than it's ever been. And it's easier to get public data and engage in things like public mapping projects during this redistricting cycle and to communicate with legislators. I think ultimately it's going to depend on people in states making their voices heard and influencing their state legislatures directly.
Nancy, what do you think through the process? Your view of the worst and the best scenario at this point?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, there's so many worlds that we could end up in the future, right? And I don't have good guesses over which one we're going to be in terms of, or do I know like what the bottom, I mean, we really have no idea what the bottom is. Like maybe there's catastrophic climate challenges and we have another more pandemics and life as we fundamentally know it ends, right? That's the worst. Hopefully that's not where we get, because we have scientists working really hard to try to prevent some of that. So I think a more reasonable kind of worst case scenario for me is from my perspective, is the slow degradation of our institutional legitimacy and the slow degradation of citizen buy-in into the process. And so what I mean by that is, you know, like, democracies only work, right? I sound like a broken record here, if people believe in them and participate in them. And I think, you know, I saw this, we've been seeing this over the last several years, where the rate at which politics moves is so quick and so requires so much background information that I see people get overwhelmed and just kind of opt out and get worn down. And I think might be seeing that with elections, right? There's so much vitriol and legalese around voting, and there's so much uncertainty over whether your precinct's going to be there or not, that at some point people are going to give up, or people might give up. I don't know if they will, right? Maybe things will change, but I think there's this real fear that what's the point? What's the point of participating? And once we're there, once enough people are like, what's the point? We're only a democracy in name. And that's kind of the worst case scenario for me, is when we all, not really all, when many of us start to opt out of participating in this democratic thing.
Expats still have the right to vote in national elections from wherever their remote location is. I'm wondering whether or not, I'm a baby boomer. I'm 70 years old. I suspect that there's a lot of people of my generation who are, and I'm not being sarcastic when I say this, are looking at a really interesting beach house in Panama or someplace else out of the U.S. because it's not enjoyable anymore to listen to the process.
Yeah, and that's I mean, Brad, depending on your perspective, the mass exodus of the boomers could be good or bad. But the idea that people are opting out because they're getting worn down is really scary, you know, and there's the tactic there, right?
For the record, at least half of my guests on the radio are pretty close to half my age. So yes, you can just run the baby boomers out of town. I'm sorry we're leaving this with a baby boomer non-joke in the process. As our listeners are used to, I do a very good job, hopefully, to get out of the way for the last few minutes, allow my guests to have the last word. I think this is a topic that is well served by doing that. Michael, I'm going to let you go first, because I would like Nancy to have the last word. So you get the first of the last word.
Absolutely.
For the record, that's also because you're on the show a lot, so we hear from you often.
You're right. People get tired of my voice, I'm sure. I would just, you know, end with the reflection that, one, on an optimistic point, the dissatisfaction and disengagement that Nancy was just talking about is a very real concern. But the thing that that we need to differentiate is that there are democratic norms. And when we look at younger generations, actually, they're the most democratically committed group in the United States, committed to the idea of democracy, maybe critical of our institutions. And we're entering a reform era, and there's going to be a lot of changes. And that's part of the democratic process as well. So I guess I am an optimist from that perspective.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mirror Mike's kind of conclusions, which is that while what we have seen in the last couple of years can be really scary at times, and while democracy does need to be nourished and nurtured by active participation and informed and an informed electorate, I'm not as cynical as I could be, right? I think that I think that there is room for improvement. I think that what that looks like can take lots of forms. It could be engaging with your family members who might have different opinions than you. It could be, from my perspective, doing my best to teach students how to understand data so that they can be informed citizens out there consuming and creating, or not creating, analyzing evidence appropriately. I caution people to not give up, right? That there are things that we can do to improve our communities and our country, but that doesn't have to be all, you know, doom and gloom all the time. Hopefully. Maybe I'm just being the Pollyanna of the department.
Well, and I thank you. And technically, while that was the last word, we have a little bit more time because you both, for college professors, you were both remarkably brief for a moment.
For a moment.
For a moment, yeah. Have either of you seen a shift in the political climate of your students? In other words, are we evolving to have more students that are skeptical enough to really look at whether or not what they're hearing is believable, or is that not where things are going?
That's an interesting question, and I think my students tend to be pretty competent, right? They're smart students who get into good schools and choose to believe political science majors, right? So there's a selection bias issue here, which is we have the students who care about these things. So yes, they are good consumers of information, more or less. Whether or not they reflect their generation as a whole, whether or not they reflect the American people, probably, I mean, they definitely don't because they're not a random sample. So I don't have an answer to that. I did have this interesting moment a couple years ago. I was teaching a judicial politics class and the students seem to have the most confidence in the Supreme Court. Right. And then there are a few selections and I'm curious to see, I'm scheduled to teach the class again this quarter. Not this quarter, this year. And I'm curious to see if the ideology of the court shapes their enthusiasm for supporting the court. But that was an unexpected thing. This movement to like the least democratic, you know, the most support for the least democratic branch was a surprise that I did not expect.
Yeah. I think we need to leave it there. And Michael, I'm sorry I didn't get a chance for your, well, that's okay. We hear from Michael often and we appreciate you both being here. And
thanks for having us.
It's a good part of the process. This is Central Coast Voices. Want to remind you that that next week I'll be back. And if you thought this week's topic was interesting and testy, next week I get to basically work with educators, both at university and high school level, who are going to tell us about the critical race theory and how it's under attack and what it really means. And if you thought this topic today was political, I'm sure that we will find next week will be as political, if not more so. Chris Kington Barker will be back in 2 weeks, but we want to be part of this process and share with you as much information that is cutting edge and as current as possible. So I appreciate you being part of this process with us. This has been Central Coast Voices, a production of Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County and KCBX. You can reach us with comments at voices@kcbx.org. Thank you to KCBX for being a partner with us in this. And thank you to our studio engineer today, Brad Kyle, for holding down the fort in the building there while we still do this by remote control. And thank you to my guest today, Dr. Nancy Arrington, and Dr. Michael Latner. This has been Central Coast Voices. We'll talk to you next week.